Today we have a guest, that's Sue Emmer, who had worked for Warner Brothers Records for 18 years, and her and I had an opportunity to work together. And it'll be great to have a promotion woman to talk to.
Well, yeah, it kind of goes along with the Women in Rock that we did a few weeks ago. And then, you know, I was thinking, well, we always say promotion man, promotion man, promotion man. And it's the perfect opportunity to get someone who is a woman who brings a whole different perspective to the podcast, who has some great stories, I understand.
Yeah, totally some great stories. And so, Sue, is that you?
It is.
Yay! Hello. Hi.
Hi.
So, L.A. Lloyd is my partner on the Promotion Man podcast.
Hey, I want
to introduce you to.
Hello. I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing good. A little cold today for what we're used to in Austin, but we'll take it.
You know, it's so crazy. I was watching the news, and I was seeing these people are digging themselves out of the snow, and we're having like an 80-degree day here. I'm sorry to rub it in, but it's extraordinarily warm and beautiful here in California. Oh, my God.
Well, my partner here, L.A. Lloyd, really likes Prince.
Yeah. Can we start there?
Oh, okay.
You want to start there?
We can start with Prince if you want to. Let's just kick right into it. Yeah, I mean, I've been a Prince fan as long as I can remember, you know, going back to his first album. So anything you can tell me that I haven't heard before and the listeners haven't heard before is always a treat.
Sure. My very first meeting with Prince. We got a phone call from Gail, who was the assistant to Russ Thyrette, the head of promotion, who said, tonight at 11 o'clock this evening, all the promotion staff, national promotion staff, were, you know, probably seven of us or so, we needed to go to a roller skating rink in West Hollywood where this new band that they signed called Prince was going to be playing. It's a crazy place on the corner of like Crescent Heights and Santa Monica Boulevard, and it's basically a place where you put on a pair of roller skates and you roll around the music. But they were going to be performing there, and we had to show up. I thought this was pretty crazy, but it must be pretty important. I mean, if we have to show up, and Russ is saying you got to be there. So, anyways, we showed up, and there we were with a bunch of people, a band that we had never heard of before, and put my skates on, started rolling around, and the next thing I knew, a guy with a trench coat on with underwear and his two sidekicks, Wendy and Lisa, also had the long coats and lingerie, which, you know, back then, you know, there was no really social media. There was none of this Kardashian stuff. There wasn't this Instagram. Not everybody was in lingerie and showing all their body parts.
Right.
And it was pretty risque. It was pretty shocking. It was wild. There it was. I mean, as for the band, Prince was, it was crazy. I mean, I couldn't believe it, you know? And this was a band that Warner Brothers was going to go after and our company really believed in. So that was my first time that I had seen the guy, knew anything about him. And the next thing I know, we're going to release an album and we're going to, work records like, Little Red Corvette in 1999 and, all the Purple Rain stuff. And
he becomes a ginormous international icon.
Right.
Right.
And you only have once to make a good first impression or a first impression, I should say.
So my question was, at the roller rink, was it a great performance?
I mean, it was a great, great music to skate to. I mean, it was real wonderful. I think, for me, working at Warner Brothers, there was this feeling amongst, I guess, everybody, is that when Warner Brothers signed an artist, there was a reason why they signed the artist. There was a belief in the musicality, the talent, all the things that you kind of wondered, really? I mean, that wasn't the first time I had been surprised by an artist. And I began to, it's like, you have to believe. And I thought, okay, this is my first, I didn't say, oh my God, this is a hit band and this is going to be huge. I just went along with the flow. I was a promotion person, a promotion woman. And when I was given my marching orders, I was told to call radio and work a record and get people excited. Specifically for what I did, I called the secondary markets, meaning I didn't call the major markets. I didn't call like Los Angeles. I didn't call New York. I called like Riverside. I called Tuscaloosa. I called the small markets. And these people in these smaller markets were really very taken aback by something like this. You know, they saw a picture of the guy.
In his underwear, in a trench coat.
But you know what? There was an excitement and a belief that, God, you know, when the Warner Brothers person called, they must know something that we don't know. So there was, I think, an openness to it. And I also became very open to it. And hey, what can I say?
You kind of have to when you go see him live and he's getting lowered from the ceiling in a brass bed just wearing a pair of panties. So I mean, it's like,
I have to ask you a question about Rod Stewart, because I started in 1978, and the very first album I was working besides the Van Halen debut was Rod Stewart, Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Oh, right. So when we signed Stewart, we had a listening party, and we were all really, really excited. I mean, listen, Rod had been around before. I mean, you know, Rod wasn't like a brand new artist that we haven't heard of. I mean, he already had somewhat of a career by the time he got to Warner Brothers, and he's releasing this, you know, this Do You Think I'm Sexy album. So we went to his private home. He lived in Beverly Hills off of Tiger Tail Road, in this incredible mansion. The promotion staff was invited to go over there, and they were gonna debut the album. I remember knocking on the door, and he didn't open up the door. This really beautiful blonde, I think it might have been, I don't know what wife it was, but one of the wives opened up, Kelly Emberg. I mean, I don't know. He's been around, and she opened up the door, and we came in, and there was Rod sitting like in a leather chair, and wearing a velvet smoking jacket.
Wow.
Okay, with that fabulous hair, you know, and he was, you know, kind of holding court. What I remember most about that experience was that when I walked into the house, what really blew my mind was he had this red shag wall-to-wall carpet, and on top of the shag carpet were these like animal skins. It was very decadent. It was a very decadent house. And apparently the home was originally the home of like one of the Chinese emperors who had built the house in Beverly Hills, and he had bought the house. So there was some history to this place.
Oh, wow.
And as we kind of moseyed around, I mean, they had drinks and like appetizers and stuff. And then we had a dinner and that with Rod, which was fantastic. And then we went into this private room, which was like a balconied room where there was like places up above where people could stand above and look down below, very high ceilings. And they played the entire album, and the promotion staff sat there, and Rod was there, and his managers were there, and his managers were really pretty funny. It was Arnold Stiefel was his name, and this guy Randy Phillips, who were directing the career of Rod Stewart at the time. And they were, you know, dancing about. I mean, it was just an amazing experience to be able to be in an intimate setting like that with an artist like Rod. Very friendly, very hospitable, very gorgeous. I wanted to know who did his hair. he had great, great hair. But, you know, it was exciting. And these are the kind of things that really propelled, you know, the promotion staff to go out, get on a phone, call radio, small markets like I did, and get people excited about an experience, an album that's coming out. The music was fun. You know, working at Warner Brothers during those years, and I was there from like 1977 to 1995, it was a fantastic time in music history. There were so many great bands that we worked with, you know, through the years. And it was a privilege. It was very exciting. It really was. It really was.
That kind of brings me to my next point. I mean, Rod, you know, was already very well established. I mean, his career was, you know, it wasn't kind of like you were calling a radio station going like, hey, I got this new artist named Rod Stewart. I mean, he was already established.
Right.
And then you
exactly.
get George Harrison laid in your lap with Got My Mind, you know, Set on You. I mean, which was a great top 40 and rock crossover as well. So tell us about working with George.
Well, you know, George Harrison came later on. I mean, it was through what I understand is that when George Harrison recorded the Traveling Wilburys album, which was a compilation of the, you know, the different artists. It was George, Roy Orbison, Jeff Lynne, and who was the other? I'm trying to remember.
Tom Petty, and Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I know that for the first time, George Harrison got a chance to meet Mo and the Warner Brothers people, and it was at that point that George really loved the Warner Brothers people. And then he ended up moving from, I think he was on Capitol or another label, moved over to Warner's and had his first album with Warner Brothers, Mindset on You, which became a gold, you know, gold album, platinum single. And I remember meeting George, and we met, I think the wonderful thing, and maybe the not so wonderful thing about meeting artists, is that sometimes I think it's better maybe not to know them. But I will tell you that George Harrison was the exception. And when the album went gold, we were asked to come into the conference room, and George personally wanted to give us, the promotion staff, hand the album to us and know who was working his record.
Wow.
Wow, that's awesome. So he personally handed everybody their gold plaque?
Yes. And, you know, usually what happened, and this sounds very, you know, sort of, oh, God, why? I would open up my mail, and there would be some kind of a box, and there would be a gold record. It would be just that was sort of the way a lot of the gold records came down. We'd open up our mail, there'd be a box. I'd go, oh, look at that. We got a gold record for Madonna or Madonna or something like that. But George had wanted the personal touch. And I think what was most endearing and special about that conversation and that experience that I had, and I'm sure the other promotion people can, you know, can chime in on this, is that George was a very down-to-earth, sweet, lovely guy who, when I spoke to him, said things like, tell me about, are you married? Do you have children? I mean, where do you live? He really wanted to know more about me. I mean, I'm standing there with a beetle, for God's sake.
Right? A beetle.
A beetle. And maybe that doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people out there, and maybe to some of
the... No, I think it does.
I think the Beatles will always be the band.
Right. I mean, for me, it was like life-changing. And the guy, he was barefoot in the conference room, and he was the most down-to-earth, sweet man that I had ever met, and just incredible vibes from him. And I think what I loved is that I don't think he really knew or felt, or the ego was just not a Beatle ego that I thought it would be. He was just this regular guy who wanted to know who I was, and the rest of the guys were in, oh, that was, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much for working my record. And it was really special. So I do have a photo that I cherish in my little office at home. So it's that moment.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah, it was wonderful.
If you'd like to share that with our audience, we'd love to put it on our social media so
yeah.
they can exactly see that, if you don't mind. We'd love to see it as well.
I'm happy to share.
So, Sue, Warner Brothers was really lucky to develop iconic artists. And another iconic artist that we had was Madonna.
Yeah.
At the very same time, we've got Prince. We also have Madonna, you know, who had kind of gone through the stratosphere on the same level as a Michael Jackson, if you will. Tell us a Madonna story.
It's not hard to forget the first time that I was introduced to Madonna, not personally. We were brought into that famous conference room, and there was a video that we were asked to watch, and it was a video of this new artist that we signed. Her name was Madonna, and I thought, oh, really?
Right.
I mean, come on. I mean, are you seriously? Madonna? Okay. She was, there was a video of Lucky Star, was, I believe, the first record that we worked, and I remember watching the video, seeing this girl that had these rags around her arms, these rags in her hair, and she was just kind of jumping around, and and I remember Russ saying, this will be the biggest artist on our label.
Wow.
This is the real deal. Get ready for this. Get ready for Madonna. My understanding was that she had worked the clubs in New York, that I guess she gave her song to Jelly Bean Benitez was involved, who was a major DJ in New York. That's how she ended up through Jelly Bean coming to Warner Brothers. And that was pretty exciting. I mean, I didn't have the same experience with Madonna that I had with George. I did meet Madonna briefly. It wasn't quite like what I had with George, but, you know, she had a vision, and she was very driven. I mean, the energy that I got from Madonna was, you know, she knew where she wanted to go, and there was nothing that was going to get in her way. That was Madonna. We did have, I know she did record a song for the movie, the Dick Tracy movie, which was put out by Warner Brothers with Warren Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
And in celebration of the album, we always had these really extravagant parties, and especially for our major artists, we went crazy. I mean, it was always some location that you can't even imagine. And this particular party was celebrated at a hotel in downtown Los Angeles, which was not a working hotel. It was an abandoned hotel that was very, very old, very vintage looking. And it was, you know, catered, and a lot of people came, and it was about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock midnight is when the party began. And we were all waiting for Madonna to show up, because when was she going to come? So she made her entrance. There was these two staircases, one on the left side, one on the right side. And I remember I saw Madonna going up one of the staircases, and I saw this other guy going up the other staircase. Looked like it could have been Warren Beatty, wasn't sure. And then the two of them walked up the staircase. They made their entrance. They got to the top of the staircase, met each other in the middle, and proceeded to give each other a very intimately warm and loving kiss.
Wow.
It was a moment.
sounds like a Gone with the Wind kind of moment.
Yeah.
It was spectacular. I don't know if everybody even saw that moment. I just remember thinking, oh my God, look what's going on. Madonna was interesting. I mean, she had a lot of hits. We worked a lot of records that were successful at Warner Brothers, and we threw a lot of parties for Madonna. So
we were together with the John Lennon Double Fantasy. Remember, we worked that record together.
Oh God, I remember when. Oh God, I remember we were. My God, that famous conference room. I remember Eddie Rosenblatt, who was the head of sales for Warner Brothers, was on the road with John Lennon during that tour. He was in New York, and I remember when we got the message in the conference room that John Lennon had been shot.
I'll never forget it. I transferred to Houston, and Richard Woolard and I were partners in Detroit. So I immediately called him to tell him the news, because I actually like woke him up. And and then we started calling radio, and it was such a shock for everybody that I was put on the air in a lot of scenarios in my Texas region, because most people wanted to just have me tell the news because it was so shocking for them to digest it. And I remember Bert Keen, he had created like there was a radio interview. I don't know if it was Z100 or what, NEW, it was probably NEW, but one of the big New York stations was where John had given an interview. What do you call it back then when it was all printed out?
A transcript?
Yeah, a transcript. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
So I remember Bert had sent us all the transcript of the interview, and it's thick. It was a very long interview.
Wow.
It's interesting. You know, I remember when Kennedy, God, I remember when Kennedy was shot. I remember exactly where I was. I remember when John Lennon was shot. You know, these are these moments, you know, when people have made some kind of an impact on you in your life, you know, especially, you know, being involved in the music and the artist assigned to our label. I mean, it was a crazy, I'll never forget that. It was such a crazy time.
When Prince died, I mean, same thing. I remember exactly where I was at when Michael Jackson died. I mean, so this is, it's never going to end with, you know, these icons that are part of our lives that we've been talking about today, because they do leave an everlasting memory.
Seal was a really big artist for Warner Brothers. Do you have anything about Seal that you could share?
Well, I think one of the highlights was the fact that we were asked to go out on our patio one afternoon, and Seal was going to, you know, perform for us. You know, we had Prince performed out there. We had many artists perform right out there on our patio. What I remember, you know, I think I met Seal once or twice, but I don't really have a story other than, you know, being out there on that patio in a, you know, an afternoon in, you know, Burbank, California, and watching an artist perform and being so excited about it, and the guy being really interesting looking. I mean, definitely, like what happened to him and what was the story, you know? That was, I think that's what you wonder about.
He's a big guy too. I mean, he's
very, very tall.
Yeah, he's tall. He's got a really nice build.
Very nice build, a beautiful, you know, like a British accent. And, you know, I briefly met him, but I really don't have any story to tell you.
Did he perform by himself? Did he have an accompaniment?
You know, he had a band. It wasn't anything. I mean, there wasn't like any famous people that decide to show up and jam with him, if that's what you're talking about.
No, I was kind of like, was it a full-on band, or was it more of like an acoustic, broken down, unplugged?
What I remember is a little bit more of an acoustic, unplugged kind of a situation. But again, you know, just the promotion staff was there. I think the entire company was invited to that one. It was just one of those moments, you know, where you just get a call and everybody's out on the patio at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and showtime. You know, the other thing I wanted to mention was when Prince in 1985, he released an album called Around the World in a Day, which is probably the song that is most familiar for most people is the Raspberry Beret. And again, we were asked to come into the conference room and wait. We were going to hear the new album, and we're waiting and waiting. And you know, there were soft drinks and some little appetizers and things. You know, we're talking, mulling around, talking to everybody. All of a sudden, the door opens up, and in walks Prince and his entourage, probably about 12 to 15 other people, all in their silk pajamas. Okay.
Nice.
It's a pajama party.
The pajama party began. And at that moment, everybody stopped what they were doing. Nobody talked. Prince made his way into the room. And he walked over to the audio equipment. He did what he had to do. He tweaked a couple buttons. You know, whatever it was, the CD, the cassette. I don't even know what he put in there back then. Walked to the middle of the room. Didn't say a word. Sat down, cross-legged on the floor. And every executive in the room sat down and we listened to this record. It was amazing. It was, he never said a word. His entourage never said a word.
That's so wild.
The album was, that was it. We listened. Lenny Warnker, Russ Dyrek, Mo Austin, the heads of promotion, Stewie, Kent, everybody, the whole department, Ed Newfer, myself, everybody sitting on that floor. And listening to a new album from our artist friends. I mean, it just was special. The album was finished. He got up. He walked out with the entourage. And that was it.
Wow.
Wow.
That's a great story.
In the world we live in today, the Me Too movement has come about. And you are a beautiful woman. Always have been. Always will be. And you started at Warner Brothers, you said, in 1977. What were the challenges for you navigating that whole industry?
There were very few women that were doing national promotion at the record labels. I mean, it was considered, you know, a man's world, a man's job, and the promotion man. And it was, when I got the job, I started there as an assistant working for three guys and decided that, you know, I think, I could do a little bit more besides answer the phone and type. I love music, and they just happened to float me into this promotion department, which I didn't even know what a radio station was or a call letter. And I started to work and started to understand what was going on. 6 months later, I was given a break, and a guy by the name of Dan Kelly believed in me. I got into the office very early in the morning, listened to what he was doing, and looked at him and said, I think I can do this. He said, I think he can do it too. And I'm making it a lot easier than it was because it was not that easy to do this. But I got a shot. And I was given a national secondary promotion job. The men in the department were not that excited about having me. You know, it was different. They weren't used to working with a woman, especially one like myself who prided themselves in being a girl. You know, I'm a girl, I'm a woman. And I was not going to be a promotion man. I was going to be a promotion woman and keep all the things that are important about being a woman. You know, I just felt like my femininity and who I am was very important. That was challenging. I was questioned quite a bit. I think that as a woman doing the job, I think that you, at that time, I felt like I had to work twice as hard and prove myself way more than any guy had to do it. But this is kind of part of the, this is part of what I had to go through. You know, talking about the Me Too movement, which is, I think that women today are so lucky because there's been a lot of barriers have been removed. And I've always felt that, you know, the best person for the job is the best person for the job. But I think that, that women today really get, have such a great, you know, so many things have been knocked down. But for myself, I mean, I never really had Me Too moments. I think because of the person that I've always been. And yes, there were situations that had come up and I felt very good about who I was. I felt very strong. I didn't feel vulnerable. And I think that the respect, you know, I was saying earlier, it's like, you know, Aretha Franklin, you know, respect yourself. I respected myself and I didn't feel like I really needed to ever be in a position that felt uncomfortable, even though there were some that I'm like, okay, I was strong enough to hold myself in a way that I think people got that message. But again, you know, it was a very interesting time. And I think because I had really supportive people around me, and especially Russ, who believed in me, that was important. When he set the tone, I think that that's why I was able to get through it. You know, I really do.
Well, and I have to say, you were one of my favorites. I was doing the Michigan secondary, so you were my teammate in a lot of ways when I was calling on Lansing and Grand Rapids and Flint and the secondary marketplaces.
I felt like, you know, it's really interesting. Most of the program directors, people that were making the decisions at the radio station, were men. And seriously, I mean, they'd really much rather speak to a woman. You know, a woman gets on the phone and it's like, oh, yeah, okay. It's a little different. I mean, as long as you know what you're doing, I think as long as you're professional and you're doing your job, you know, I mean, they'd much rather speak to a woman. And I think that they knew that. I think that our you know, Russ and the top brass over there knew that it was a complete advantage.
I think Russ knew that radio guys don't ever get laid very often, so to hear a woman's voice was exciting.
Right. Like, who is this girl? What's going on? Who is this girl in California, you know, in L.A. that's calling me, wants to talk to me? I mean, I thought it was a complete advantage, you know? And I loved it. Was for me, I think they felt that there was somebody that, first of all, cared about them. Okay, someone was paying attention. Someone was excited about music. Someone was relaying those stories that were happening back on the West Coast. I mean, that's fun. That's you know, that's a little different than hearing from, no offense, guys, but hearing from you guys, you
right,
know?
Right.
A little different take on things, you know?
Totally. Yeah, we mixed it up a little bit.
And oh, it was such, you know, I have to say, when I look back on my history and look back on those days of, you know, working records, talking to people on the phone, I enjoyed it from a music standpoint. I learned, and also from just learning about people all over the country. I mean, places that I had never been to before. I mean, you live in Los Angeles. L.A. is a pretty, you know, it's a spot where it's not the rest of the country.
No.
It's not. And I think that I learned a lot about the world out there. And a lot about what people do and how people see things. And I learned a lot. And I have like very fond memories of those days. So
good. Well, thank you so much thank you so much for calling in. It's been a pleasure to reconnect with you. And thanks for being a guest on Promotion Woman today. Promotion Woman today.
I hope you get some great stories.
Thank you,
Sue.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. So there you go, Fred. Promotion Woman. She had some great stories. I mean, I love the Prince pajama party. That was really awesome. I mean, what else did we learn? Rod Stewart's got a swanky pad.
Yeah,
and
Rod
good
Stewart's
hair.
Got a swanky pad and good hair. And
George
Shag
Harrison is such a super down-to-earth guy.
Humble guy.
Madonna, definitely focused, knew what she wanted. And Seal is the dapper gentleman who can just still get those girls to drop their panties like no other.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know if we learned that or not, but I just, it was in my head.
It's your own interpretation. Another great podcast.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you indeed. And don't forget to share it. And of course, we will talk to you again next week right here on Promotion Man.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.